This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ah! Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That is so amazing.
That's the sound of Tiffany getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be donating bathrobes to an entire senior center. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the 2023 CR-V Hybrid Sport. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Thank you for downloading the Digital Human Podcast. This week, we're finding out if how we treat our subservient robots might have an impact on how we treat each other. Alexa, turn on the lights in the living room.
Okay.
Alexa, play the news.
Here's your flash briefing in BBC News from TuneIn.
Alexa, stop. Alexa, what happens if I say please to you?
I'm not sure.
Today on The Digital Human, we're looking at how the way we treat our domestic robots affects how we treat one another. Follow the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag DigiHuman. Now, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I live in a house full of robots. We live in the future. That's my family and I, and we share our space with a little horde of servant machines that turn the lights on and off, or they set timers, or they give us the news. Sometimes it does make me a little uncomfortable. As with any new invention, though, domestic robots show us our human edges, those social niceties that we assume that everyone adheres to, but it turns out not everybody does. It's just like any new relationship, isn't it?
My name's Rachel Withers, and I'm a freelance writer covering technology for Slate, and I wrote an article about the way people interact with their Alexa devices titled "I Don't Date Men Who Yell at Alexa." So it was a guy I was dating for a few weeks. You know, he was a perfectly nice guy, but every time we walked into his apartment, the first thing he would do would be to bark a command at Alexa, asking her to turn the lights on. And it was always in a very sharp, commanding tone, and it really grated on me every single time he spoke to the device. But the lights on stands out in my mind because the light switch was right there. So I would have to hear it unnecessarily. And it was my first interaction with a smart speaker. It was when they were very new. And at first I couldn't tell if this was just something about these devices that I found personally obnoxious. It seemed like he was showing off. It was new technology. But he also just sounded like incredibly entitled and demanding. I knew it was the tone that was really, really bothering me. I just couldn't stand to hear it.
Our human tendency to anthropomorphize is part of who we are. By giving a non-human, human-like qualities, it helps us to make sense of the things that we just don't know. Our new digital devices capitalize on that. They have human voices and they have natural intonations in their speech. They tell jokes. And that can make it hard for our monkey brains to treat them like simple machines. We're taught to be polite when actual people speak to us or they do something for us. So should we transfer the politeness that we have for people onto the digital helpers in our lives? Would it feel better if we said the magic word?
A lot of saying please is about what we believe we want from other people. We say please because we either want someone to feel valued or we want something from that person. My name is Cheryl Platts, and I'm a user experience designer. What I usually tell people is user experience designers are the folks who try to make it so you don't want to throw your computer across the room. And I've had the good fortune to work on a number of projects, and one that's particularly captured the public interest is these digital assistants.
We have to understand where in the pecking order robots sit in order to know the appropriate way to interact with them. We could go literal and take the original Czech meaning of robota, forced labor, but that seems a pretty slippery slope to me.
It's interesting to go deeper into our relationship with these devices. Do we perceive them as servants? Do we perceive them as assistants? Do we perceive them as hired help? Do we perceive them as family members or friends? I think there's a lot we can learn about ourselves through that process. You could argue that one model that customers might resonate with is a very clear delineation. The device is hired help. You don't have an established relationship with them. It keeps things very clear. And that means you don't feel guilty when you're making requests. But at the same time, that model works best when you can also model that clear division in the way your home is organized. We look at Downton Abbey, you know, the servants live downstairs, the family lives upstairs. You can't really do that with these digital assistants. They are always present. They are always in the home. And so then I think you start to get into questions of, is it uncomfortable to continue to treat something as a servant that is there as much, if not more, as one of your family members? Like the fact that Alexa sits, or Cortana sits, essentially at the couch with us, it's only natural for us to want it to feel like part of the family because that's where the family congregates.
And things get even more complicated because we've developed a habit of treating these machines like confidants.
I think it was about a year or two ago now, but Apple's Siri team posted a job opportunity for essentially a psychiatrist to help them deal with the volume of requests that were coming into Siri of a critical sort of crisis nature. People asking questions about being depressed or being suicidal or asking for help like that. Even if you have friends, we all have moments where we need companionship and maybe there's not someone there when we need them. Is there a genuine human benefit that these devices can play in those situations? It's dangerous, but potentially also very beneficial. It breaks my heart to think of those people talking to Siri and asking those questions. But they're also asking those questions because maybe they don't feel judged. That's another benefit that these assistants can provide us. Like, humans judge a lot, but devices are perceived as slightly more neutral, at least at this point in our technology evolution. So can we use that to our advantage and find a way to help people that way? I think there's a lot of really interesting questions to ask and answer in different ways when it comes to companionship, our relationship, and whether these assistants should always be service-oriented or whether there's some form of companionship that's appropriate or beneficial.
So what are they? Companions? Servants? Joanna Bryson is an associate professor in the Department of Computing at the University of Bath. She wrote an article with a provocative title.
There's actually two different questions. Why did I title it Robots Should Be Slaves, and what does it actually say? What I actually say is that artificial intelligence is an artifact. It's something that somebody's deliberately built and they are buying and selling it. So therefore, it's something that's owned. And a lot of people really, really want AI to be a person. But then you would have a person that you owned. It's a bit ironic, the title is eye-grabbing, but what it's really saying is that given that we're going to buy and sell robots, they cannot be people. We shouldn't even want to aspire to make people because we've already established it's wrong to buy and sell people. So what the article is about the owned nature of artificial intelligence. That was sort of an argument to try to convince people who hadn't been convinced by the technological reasons that robots aren't actually people.
We know that, but we are confused by these machines that talk to us. We're at a point in time where many of us believe that the degrading inequalities of fierce hierarchies should be ancient social history. But now that we've introduced artificial intelligences into this mix, we're discovering that these inequalities actually persist. In general, they're applied to little digital talking servants. Maybe, in a couple of generations, attitudes to AI will have changed. Dr. Patrick Allitt is professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta.
It was only in the late 19th century that humanitarianism really developed. I think it was in the 1860s that the National Association for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children developed, and the RSPCA to prevent cruelty to animals developed. I mean, by the late 19th century, there was a widespread feeling that our common humanity was more important than the things that kept us apart. But as you go further back in time, you find far less of that. It wasn't till the mid-1700s that even the idea of abolishing slavery developed. And at first, it was regarded as a kind of crackpot notion that only Quakers and strange radicals would have. And yet, gradually it caught on. And in the 1830s, slavery was abolished throughout the British Empire. But then humanitarian reformers in Britain began raising more questions. What about people who are not slaves, but nevertheless work in extremely subordinate positions and are often ill-treated or at the mercy of their masters and mistresses? That's something which ought to stop.
The head of the household had so much power that he could even take away your name.
If you had a scullery maid, she was going to be called Mary. And if you had a cleaner, she was going to be called Betty, and so on. So that's right. That's a way of even taking away the servant's actual name, because a standard name had come to represent that particular form of work. There's no question that the servants had to put up with a lot.
But despite this, the idea of actually changing things, well, that took a lot before it caught on. As humans, we seem to be wired for hierarchy, for the people at both ends of the power spectrum. At the time, there was no realistic way to move around, either up or down. So why spend time thinking about it?
If you grew up in a working class family, the idea of your social inferiority was hammered into you almost from the day of your birth. When young men and women, mainly women, got jobs as servants, they probably knew right from the outset that there was no question at all of them being treated as equal, and probably very often they didn't feel it. I mean, we know that one of the difficulties, even for people like the first Labour MPs, was to feel that they were entitled to speak up in Parliament, even though they'd been elected, because they were overawed by the circumstances in which they found themselves. They often felt themselves to be in a position and in a place which hadn't originally been designed and built for people like themselves. Even though now, we cherish the idea of human equality, I think that's something that had to be learned. I mean, the tradition of, which is very widespread, for example, in coal mining families, I worked in the pit and my son's going to work in the pit. So, yes, the social classes were preserved from both sides. And this feeling of getting a sense of security from being in the social position to which fate had placed you was very powerful.
We progressed. We ostensibly left the rigid social class structure behind. But in its absence, there are new problems, not least of which is how do we handle fluidity now that those clear lines are gone?
So if you have this very strong power relationship, you're the president of a company and you have the secretary, and you think it's really just great that you come in every day and you tell a joke and the secretary laughs. You may feel like, oh, we're great friends, but then, you know, the secretary steps out of line and you suddenly fire them and get another secretary. You can have a difficult masquerade relationship with real people and also with animals. Recently, there was a thing where people no longer referred to themselves as owners of dogs, but as parents of dogs, because they needed to be aware of all the responsibilities they had towards the dog. But it's still an animal. It's still locked up in the house in a way you would never lock up an actual child. There's no way to inform the dog about all of its rights and responsibilities, right? At least with AI, we can totally take it apart. We can ensure ourselves that the system is not suffering. There's no problem with it being owned.
And therefore, they can be our slaves, right?
Part of the confusion we have about assistants and tools is because once we held that confusion about human beings,
Professor Kathleen Richardson is a robot ethicist at De Montfort University in Leicester.
Aristotle, for example, wrote a description of what he thought a slave was. And he said a slave was an animate tool. Property can be living and inanimate. So he called a slave a sort of living piece of property. And because we've lived in a culture where we've carried around ideas that human beings actually can be tools and forms of property, we actually also live in a culture where the opposite can also seem true. Slaves were never living tools, but there was an elite masterclass in ancient Greece who wanted to use human beings like they use the other tools in their society. And for them, there was no difference. But for the actual slaves, there is a clear difference. And that's why they had slave rebellions. Whereas, as far as I know, no hammers and chisels ever fought back against their human rulers. And I think once we start using a language like a slave, which is a social, economic, political phenomena that marks extreme cruelty and dehumanization of human beings, and start transferring that language onto how we think about appliances in our lives, I think that's a very dangerous cultural move.
Okay, so we haven't actually decided what these devices are. Are they equals? Are they slaves? Do they transcend human metaphor completely? Because applying any human metaphor to them dehumanizes people. In many ways, establishing a precise pigeonhole to put these bots in is unnecessary. As with so many marvelous clues about our social behavior, it comes down to what the people around us do. These indicators prove much more powerful than any chiseled stone commandments that you might find lying around. So let's look a little more deeply at the domestic machines and figure out what the people who made them are telling us. Rachel Withers again.
That was something I touched on in the article, is this ties into sort of the outdated idea of like a man having a woman in the home who's supposed to respond to his beck and call, which reinforces the connection between subservience and women. Alexa is not a woman. I want to make it clear that I'm not anthropomorphizing these devices. But I do think having a specifically female voice around the home that you can yell at when you get home, that you can demand things of. We don't know yet what kind of effects this technology is going to have on people's speech patterns and attitudes and personalities. And I think as a woman, you're particularly attuned to these little displays of aggression and what they might mean, even when they're not accompanied by physical aggression.
Oh my. Yes, we are going there. Because it hasn't been long since women were automatically assumed to be subservient, as Patrick Allitt explains.
The advice was, it's much better to get female than male servants. And if you do have male servants, try to make sure that they're working mainly outdoors. The assumption was, on the whole, it's much better to have female servants because they're less difficult, they're less ill-behaved, and they're more likely to be deferential and tractable.
Uh-huh. Well, we might not have completely shaken off certain beliefs.
We are a capitalist society. The companies building these devices want them to be accepted. And there's a fantastic researcher at Stanford a few years ago, a man named Clifford Nass, who did a bunch of research about how humans perceive devices that speak. And specifically, he also researched how people perceive devices that speak with gendered qualities, you know, that sound male, that sound female. And his research indicated that when customers heard a device speaking in a male voice about a topic that was perceived to be female, it caused them what we call cognitive dissonance. It felt uncomfortable to them. It didn't seem right. And, you know, vice versa, if you heard a female voice talking about male topics, his findings were that it caused that cognitive dissonance. So if you look at the capabilities these devices had when they started, you know, you look at Alexa, some of the most commonly used features are kitchen timers and appointments and to-do lists and shopping lists. These things are currently associated with female qualities. And so if you made, my theory is that they may have tested both male and female voices, but found that the female voice was preferred because of the way culture perceives the tasks the devices started out doing.
Joanna Bryson.
The problem here is, why is it that you find it so pleasant to tell women what to do and make women do what you tell them to do? So there's a question about whether it is ethical to sell people what they want, because we haven't necessarily unpacked all the stuff behind that. So, you know, maybe having female, they're called intelligent speakers now. I call them like personal digital assistants still. However you want to call it, making that female might be like, you know, now when we look and we see people that painted those things that you could tie your horse to and they painted them like black people. And we find that repulsive now. Maybe in 20 years, we'll find it equally repulsive that people used to treat robots as females or disguise them as females.
I certainly hope so, because if the way we speak to our devices inherently demotes them, we are, by extension, demoting the persona that has been created to represent them. Cheryl Platts again.
And I think there's really a need for a generation of psychologists to take a serious look at whether or not these devices cause unconscious bias or conscious bias, and if so, what behaviors need to change, what design aspects of the systems need to change. That's the whole thing with technology that's powerful. It doesn't matter what you intended it to do or what impact you intended it to have. You have to accept that humans behave in unexpected ways and things may have unexpected consequences. I talk about a concept I call optopessimism. Ask yourself both what is the best possible effect your system can have and the worst possible effect your system can have. And then keep an eye out for those things. And if those worst possible impacts are genuinely causing people harm, go out of your way to prevent that harm from occurring.
This is a harm that is transmitted from generation to generation through how we behave, from the things that we let pass to the things that make us angry enough to speak out about. If our behavior is telling the other people that it's okay that female voices are subservient and it's okay to shout at robots, then that becomes the unconscious bias that Cheryl is talking about. But because these devices are so new, we have an opportunity to break this pattern. And where better to reboot our social relationships with robots than the very people for whom Alexas and Cortanas and Siris and Google Homes are already a mundane part of the furniture.
Alexa, what do you look like?
I look like lots of ones and zeros.
That's so funny.
There's no question that close relationships did often spring up between servants and children, especially if the servant was working in the nursery or was a nanny. But at the same time, one of the ways in which the progress of the children in growing up would be marked was their learning to distance themselves from the servants.
Alexa, tell a joke.
Did you hear about the pirate who became a great chef? He mastered the seven seasonings.
That was terrible. That was a dad joke, wasn't it?
Hey.
These are devices that are designed for kind of our most intimate spaces. It's not just that there are lots of people around, but it's the people who are closest to you that you're usually around when you're interacting with these devices. It's your kids, it's your partners. And those are people who I think are especially attuned to the various inflections and tones and moods in your voice and are especially affected by it. So it's not just people on the bus who have to hear you. It's people who live with you who are hearing you speak either courteously or aggressively or angrily to a robot.
Kathleen Richardson.
This is actually the most important question I think we need to ask ourselves as a culture. There is this idea that the way that people interact with objects somehow impacts on how they interact with other human beings. And if you can facilitate or regulate people's relationships with property, basically, then somehow there'll be this miraculous transformation in interpersonal relations between human beings. That is absolutely wrong. It's reality turned on its head. What happens between human beings, so their interpersonal relationships with each other, is what actually shapes how they interact with the world around them.
This is one of the core theories of developmental psychology. Kids learn how to behave in the world by watching what the adults around them do.
Human beings become human through interpersonal relationships with each other. We learn how to speak, we learn how to walk, we learn how to develop our emotions, regulate them, develop our intelligence.
And if we're shouting at the machine, then the people around us will learn that shouting at a machine is how we're supposed to interact with them. And if that machine happens to have a female voice, well, you know where I'm going with this. Naturally, technology thinks that it's provided the solution. Amazon received emails from parents around the world asking the tech company to help teach manners to their children, responding only, for example, if they were requested with a please. And they provided. Is it doing the trick? Cheryl Platts.
My point to a lot of parents is that imposing sort of social taxes on kids doesn't always work the way we intend. When we tell kids they have to eat their vegetables, does that always result in the desired behavior? Or does it result in gaming the system? How many folks have told their kids they need to eat vegetables and the kids have hidden them, thrown them away, found some other way to avoid doing the task that was asked of them? I think it's more important to ask ourselves what additional value modeling polite behavior with these digital assistants can have on kids. Back in the early 90s, psychologists discovered the concept of mirror neurons. Essentially, our brains operate the same way when we do something as when we see someone else do something. And that's a lot, it gets into how we learn as human beings. But when we apply that to politeness in the home and kids and digital assistants, could we reinforce politeness and help raise our kids better by parents modeling polite behavior to the device than just saying this behavior is only for kids? Like, kids have to be polite, but parents don't. Then we're just telling them that behavior changes when you get older. So again, it's like, yes, the device should respond to politeness and maybe even respond better to politeness. But I would argue there's just as much value, if not more value, in saying that the adult needs to be polite to the device to model the kind of social contract we want them to have as adults with other people, with other women, with devices, whatever. I don't think you can gamify things like politeness with a simple, you should do this, and expect it to take effect without unintended consequences.
Actually, this idea that somehow that what goes on inside people's interpersonal relationships can be, you can take out some important relationship from a person's life and insert a machine and it will start to do the same thing that a human being done, is a very dangerous road that we are traveling down.
If we don't take responsibility for how we behave to these devices, others may make judgments about who we are as human beings for us. It has nothing to do with how we think the device will feel. This is why Rachel Weathers uses Alexa as one of her barometers of good dating material.
I later dated a man who spoke to his Alexa just at a normal room tone. His Alexa was phrased more like a question. It was, Alexa. That was the first time I realized that these devices didn't have to be like repulsive and unattractive to me. It's not that it matters to the bot, how you speak to it. There's no moral responsibility to be kind to a robot. I think it just reveals the potential in somebody to be especially petulant and demanding when they're in a position of authority. I mean, I don't say please to it, but I do try to speak in a pleasant tone of voice. It's the first thing I speak to in the morning. I ask it to play the daily for me every morning. And I think it matters that the first words that leave my lips are said in a polite tone. It sets the tone for my entire day. Same as how smiling can improve your mood, I do think speaking more pleasantly will put you in a more pleasant mood. I don't think we need to think of them as human, but I do think setting the tone from the start will just make everybody's lives more pleasant.
Many of us are learning to live with robots in our homes. We use them to take notes for our shopping lists or organize our diaries, sometimes to give us companionship or to tell us the weather. And by opening up our most intimate spaces to them, we are reintroducing outdated domestic hierarchies. It's a digital class system of sorts. But as with all new technologies, it's not the device that's making us do this. It's our existing offline conscious and unconscious biases that help to shape those interactions. We have an opportunity to change that, but we have to do the hard work ourselves. We shouldn't just delegate that to a machine. For all the research that went into this episode, go to thedigitalhuman.tumblr.com and to our BBC website. Thank you for listening to The Digital Human. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Ann Duffy. The researcher was Zoe Morrison, and it was presented by me, Alex Krotowski. And if you want to model some good behavior for your fellow humans, and maybe some robots, rate us on iTunes.